First state in your county, 2250, state of Ohio versus state of Maine.
Some people don't have a sense of humor, though.
Yeah.
See a lot of these kind of cases, and it only means that there's confusion with the line of cases with Deem and Rhodes and Kidder and all of those cases. Do you have any good idea how we can straighten this out?
Well, Your Honor, I would propose strictly following Rule 30A, requiring the writing of objections.
Okay, forget the waiver issue.
Okay, this is the second issue.
How do we go about determining the elements test and all of that, something that is a lesser included offense? When I practiced, what we used to do is just ask the judge for a lesser included offense instruction on the basis that the evidence supported it. And we didn't go through, does this element or that element have to be there before we go ahead and have the instruction? And since we've done the elements test, you know, almost every week in our motions for cert, we see one of these cases. Or more.
What we propose is that essentially that the test remaining be the test similar to what's in Shane, the objective and subjective test, that we look at, first of all, how an ordinary person react to the situation that they be driven beyond, be stressed beyond their control. And subjective test whether this particular defendant is actually influenced in some fashion of their brain. I think it is somewhat of a factual determination, and that's why I feel like the trial court determination should be upheld in this instance. In this particular case, it's been clear to me that the provocation must be serious. And the provocation has to be such that bring on extreme stress and incite arousal and use deadly force. And I don't think there's any question when you have a retrieving victim unarmed that deadly force is not warranted. In this particular case, even with the presence of the TMA, which was present earlier, questionably not present when the defendant began his journey towards the victim. I think it's clear
when you cite Deem, don't we, by necessity, get into the elements testing test?
Well, I think we do have to test it. We have to test the elements, yeah.
And if we test the elements, don't you lose?
I don't think that what Deem says This talks about concerning the emotional and mental state of the defendant and the conditions and circumstances.
I'm talking about the part of Deem and Kidder and Rhodes and those other cases that say that you have to have every element of the greater offense except one for the lesser included offense to be given, the elements test.
Well, this is, I think what we're dealing with being that's an offense of inferior degree as opposed to a lesser included. I think it's almost impossible not to have all of the elements of greater offense and all of it. It's impossible not to have all the elements of the greater offense and not have if you do have sufficient elements for the defense of the lower degree, the defense of the lower degree includes all the elements of the greater offense. So
not always. In fact, every week we see that it doesn't.
Not all cases. In this case, it does.
Okay. You want to place this case on a factual basis, not necessarily the elements test.
Well, I'd like I'd like to look back in this case, of course, yeah.
Okay.
And I think that in this particular situation, I think that we're talking about aggravated assault, and as a result, yeah, there's one assault relationship between the two, which is what we have in this case. I think that you have to have one assault when you have the aggravated assault, just no instance in this case.
Counselor, is there any difference between the term lesser included offense and offense of inferior degree?
I think there is a difference. I don't think it really matters in this particular case.
Well, it matters when you look at your second proposition of law that is difficult for me to comprehend anyway, because you talk about there, I think, an inferior, as a different degree. Now we have different degree of felonious assault, inferior degree, and a lesser included offense. Is there any difference, or is that a semantical argument?
I think it's more semantical. I do believe that in this particular case, the arguments of the state certainly don't appear to hold water. Quoting the Shane case and saying that this is words alone, if you read the transcript and if you read the various facts that were cited in the briefs, this is a situation where the defendant showed up with a history of having been threatened by this victim, with a history of his fiance having been beaten and battered women. So why would the victim coming out of his house with some big object behind his back, which turns out to be a can of mace, and with him making threatening gestures on that occasion? So there's a lot of history that needs to be considered if you're going to say whether he was seriously provoked. And there's a lot more words that apply here. I don't know if that answers the court's question.
No. When we said in Dean, and used the term, as a different degree of felonious assault, how many degrees of felonious assault can there be? It's either felonious assault or it isn't. Isn't that right?
Either felonious assault or it isn't, unless, of course, other elements are present, such as aggravation here, making an aggravated
okay.
assault.
Okay, I just want to stop with felonious assault. Are there different degrees of felonious assault?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay, so when we said that in Deem, maybe that's where the confusion started to creep in. In this case, are the elements between aggravated assault and felonious assault different?
The elements, I believe, to be the same, except that...
What about provocation?
Well, that element is different. And when you find the presence of provocation, then you must charge the jury, give them the domain, give them the option of finding the defendant guilty of aggravated assault.
Okay, well, if there's provocation and that is different, then the elements are not the same.
There's an additional element necessary for aggravated assault. All the other elements, I believe, would be the same. I hope I don't have to address with any detail the argument that the defendant is stopped from raising this appellate error by his counsel's failure to put the proposed instructions in writing. He, in great detail, orally and on the record, gave the trial judge the elements for aggravated assault and argued for it. The trial judge was, in fact, very experienced and had been on the bench for decades. In fact, he was retired by mandatory age requirements. He was sitting as a substitute judge, and the elements were well stated by the trial counsel. The trial court was apprised of the charge that was requested as required by the Walmans case. The trial court explained why it wasn't going to give it, simply it didn't agree that the aggravation was sufficient to warrant the charge. So I believe that that issue should be, in fact, in this case, at least a dead issue. As far as the subjective arguments, the facts are pretty clear. The state argues some public policies that I would review briefly, stating that that if the court allows, mandates the aggravated assault charge, we're going to have defendants come into court and their counsels are going to tactically refuse to ask for another charge of a lesser included offense so that they can appeal it later. Obviously, that would be from their prison cells, and I wouldn't want to take a chance on that type of imposture as a defense counsel. So I don't think there's a public policy issue that would mandate hearing this appeal at all. And when you consider the facts, I think certainly it was the jury's domain to decide whether the defendant was sufficiently provoked to use deadly force. And again, I don't want to obfuscate, and I think the state has done that, the issue of self-defense, because it isn't self-defense. He wasn't justified in using a knife and tapping it, but he wasn't provoked into it, so.
Would you go through again those activities that you feel were in provocation?
Sure. I think in my particular appellate brief, they're listed on page 12, in a summary of the little paragraph. The defendant, Mr. Mack, was in a romantic relationship with the victim of a strange wife, so he knew her pretty well. He met her at the Battered Women's Program of downtown YWCA. So he had heard from her a history of abuse by the victim.
No, I mean the acts or activities that were gone through at the scene.
At the scene, okay.
Yeah.
At the scene, I understand that the complainant came down in a belligerent manner, held something behind his back.
What does that mean, belligerent manner?
He's posturing like I'm going to do something to you and threaten him. I believe there was a quote about that, about kicking someone's ass, if I may quote it.
Okay.
And with a bald fist, making a gesture towards the woman.
Okay.
Well, the defendant stood off to the side and watched all this and was aware of history and aware of some threats that he had been made for him about what the victim was going to do to him. Readily, he could be provoked. And even if you recognize it to be a candidate, I'd be afraid of someone spraying me, and I'd want to react.
Okay.
Either fight or flight, one of the two.
Does that go to self-defense?
Was that it?
Yeah.
If you consider the history, I think that's the basic gist.
Let's get to the activities at the scene. Here's a man who has to make a judgment, right? Mm-hmm. He has to judge whether or not his life is in danger.
Or that of his fiance.
Correct?
Or that of someone close to him.
No, I'd just like to, the belligerent manner in walking down with his hand behind his back, I think that's all you've told me so far. What else did he do?
Well, if you consider the whole history,
let's stay at the scene. We've got to see what's going through the mind of this person to justify his activity, don't we?
We do, but I don't think we have to do it in a vacuum. Although
I think we ought to do it with something that he is able to see and be heard at the scene. So those are the things that we usually judge activity of a person on. What's happening there at the scene that causes him to think he's going to be killed?
She's there to pick up her children and take them on visitations.
Okay.
He doesn't bring them down, the victim complaining. He leaves them up in the room. She's sorely wants to see the children, and he's playing a game with her. So she doesn't really feel free to leave and doesn't want to leave until she gets the children. So obviously he has this empowerment that he can make her stay there. Now, if he simply came out and said a few cuss words and balled his fist up and they felt free to leave without losing a real right they had, then I think that maybe there would be provocation. But here he doesn't say you can't have the kids. He says, come on up in the room with me. You know, I've beaten you before. I sent you to the Battered Women's Program. But you come up behind this locked door, leave your boyfriend over here, and I'll in fact deal with you up there. We'll see if you get your visitation. I'm going to blow my fist up. I'm going to cuss this guy out. I've got something behind my back at this moment. And we've got this defendant standing over here, and he's no intellectual giant, and he's got to make this decision under these circumstances. With the history involved, and he has to make this call. And we're not saying he was necessarily rational or right, but we're saying he was provoked.
So with all this information in his mind, what did he then do?
He then pursues comes after him, pulls a knife out.
Now, comes after who?
Comes after the complainant.
Okay. Did he have the knife out before that?
It's not clear from my recall, but I think that he came after him to ward off and intervene between him.
So he had to take the knife out of his pocket?
He took the knife out of his pocket.
Open it?
Took it out of the sheath.
And then what happened?
And then he chased him.
Okay, what did he do?
For a few feet. Until he caught him at the car.
So the victim was retreating?
He was running away.
Okay. What happened?
He caught the victim at the car when the victim fell.
And what did he do?
And then there's a factual disagreement.
Well, what's the best facts on your side?
The best facts on my side are he came up and got in his face and cussed him out. And the victim grabbed him, and at that point he stabbed.
Did the victim have anything in his hands?
Not that we know of. Not that's in the record, no.
How often did he stab him?
Five times.
Five times?
By state's testimony.
And where were those stab wounds?
Midsection, I think.
Midsection?
Yes.
Stabbed him five times in the midsection. This is because he was in fear of his life?
No, otherwise it would be self-defense, because he was provoked.
I'm sorry, you're right. You feel that he is justified through provocation and reduced to aggravated assault to do this?
Yes, I do. Because I feel that there was elements of provocation such that he was provoked to take, to use fatal force.
Okay.
Not that he was right, or he wouldn't be convicted of anything.
Well, really, you only have to convince us that there was evidence that a reasonable juror could have found provocation, therefore he was entitled to the instructions. In terms of self-defense as opposed to provocation, that as Justice Sweeney took you through the scenario, the testimony of the defendant in this trial, can you point to his testimony as opposed to the scenario that you paint in the brief? It seemed to me in reading his testimony that he really only testified about his fear, and that, which I'm wondering if that only goes to self-defense, and that the provocation, I really didn't see his testimony going to provocation. It was all fear. Why were you stabbing him? He says, I stabbed him because he wouldn't let go of my jacket. Fear for himself, as opposed to raging about this whole battered, his friend, girlfriend, whatever.
I noted that too, and I agree with you that he does fixate and focus on the fear aspect in explaining his conduct. But I think that unless we're going to get into a semantic and reverse type of testimony where a defense counsel says, now you tell him how mad you were and how provoked you were. And that would be very reversed and semantical. Definitely implicit.
The test is, though, we look at it objective. Would an objective, reasonable person be whose passion be so aroused that they would be provoked to deadly force? And then subjective, what was the effect of the rage on this particular defendant? That's our test, isn't it?
It is.
How do we apply that here?
Well, you're talking about objectively, and we've discussed the elements that qualify as what occurred and what the history was.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're saying subjectively, he talked about being afraid. Well, it's not necessarily in the record. This man is on disability for nervous condition.
If it's not in the record, then it's not before us, counsel. You know, that's not fair, is it?
Well, we are supposed to consider this particular victim subjectively and this particular defendant subjectively.
First, doesn't, in terms of the legal application of this concept, don't we first, does the defendant have to first qualify under the objective standard, and then the secondary test is subjective? Isn't that how we should apply it?
I think you are supposed mm-hmm. to do that, and I think if you do it, you'll find that the trial court should have given that charge, because he could have found him not guilty of felonious assault, guilty of aggravated.
And then, you know, the other troubling thing is not only do we have to find objectively that someone was provoked, but then there's a level of provocation that has to be provoked to the point of using deadly force. It's understandable why courts seem to get mixed up between this as a mitigating factor and self-defense as a complete defense. But this is only to be a mitigating factor. But the whole idea of what level of provocation is enough for the use of deadly force as the objective test, that's so very close to the analysis we give to self-defense that it's
that's why
you really got to meet it.
I ask the court to direct its attention to the legal argument that the jury could have found him not guilty because, in fact, the trial court preempted that area of choice, and that's where the error comes. I'm not saying that we heard. I don't think we need to decide that. That'd be for the right, because that's not the issue. I have nothing else to say.
Thank you, Mr. Wilman.
Thank you.
Mr. Amarante, you saved almost 6 minutes of your time.
I would like to address some factual issues. I think that it's correct that you do have a
we're talking about showing serious provocation here, not just provocation. It does have to be sufficiently serious to incite someone using deadly force.
On an objective basis.
Correct.
That's the first test.
The reasonable person has to be incited to using deadly force. In this particular instance, our position as a matter of law, he knew he was unarmed, he knew he was retreating, he achieved the purpose for which he chased him, was to get him away from the strange wife. It wasn't just chasing a couple of feet, they chased him across the street and behind the car. So he had succeeded in getting him away. He claimed he had fear that he would hurt. The fear was that she would hurt the wife. Actually, he would hurt the wife, not the fear for himself.
So the trial court here refused to give the instruction for the lesser included, and we look at, I'm sorry, whatever, and we are to look at that in, on what standard of review?
Well, I just echo back to my first proposition of law that it's not preserved.
Well, no. Assuming the error having been preserved, we look at that on an abuse of discretion standard, don't we, counsel? That's a tough standard, though, to say that court abused its discretion, isn't it?
Correct. That's why the court appeals have been on its mandate. It did reverse the trial court's decision. I think the I'd also like to point out, for the purposes of the preservation argument, that I don't feel the elements of the defense were detailed. There was discussion of the name Dean was put out there, that pursuant to Dean, we should be given this, we should be given this instruction, and that was it. There was no discussion of shame, no discussion of objective subject and test. While the court does state the elements of the offense itself during the discussion, pursuant to Dean, the court never lowered in the case below as the discussion of the objective subject and client chain. So it's my position that if you're looking for a Wallen's type of exceptions, you might need to the objection requirement. And it's our position to ask about the RS case either because it wasn't a full price of the law in this case. And it's our position also that the difference between is not semantic between a defense of a lesser degree and a lesser included offense. The defense of a lesser degree would be an offense that includes mitigating elements, whereas lesser included offense would be an offense that doesn't include all of the elements of the greater charge. And for that reason, it's impossible to find someone, in this case, to find someone guilty of aggravated assault without also finding all of the elements of felonious assault. Because in this case, all the elements of felonious assault are included in aggravated assault, but aggravated assault also has the additional mitigating elements. So I think that's what the difference is here in this particular case. And as I indicated, it's our position that the facts in this case are clear that they're clear that he was unarmed. The altercation with the hand behind back took place well before the incident where the defendant came forward with a knife. He had his hand behind his back supposedly when he first came out of the house. This took place at his house. He came over to pick up the children at his house. It took place right at the front of the top of the driveway, right outside the door to the apartment complex where he lived. And it was the defendant coming from the end of the driveway, almost the sidewalk of the driveway, with the knife drawn and pulled from the sheath that he had hanging under his arm. He came up with the knife drawn towards the victim, and the victim didn't know he had a choice to do at the time as he ran. And if you tried to defuse the situation, the defendant escalated the situation.
Well, that argument really goes to self-defense, doesn't it, counsel, as opposed to the mitigating element?
It does, yes. It's not, we don't feel that it represents the provocation in question. The provocation, no provoking acts were what took place before he was chased across the street and actually stabbed.
So you say any passion that any evidence of a passion and provocation in a reasonable person would have diminished prior to the stabbing?
Well, I think they would have, if he had any passion, that would have stated he was trying to do is to get him get the victim away from the wife. Once that is achieved, then we then move beyond passion. Now, in passion, sufficient to incite death and divorce. Which is to amend this being, needs to be convicted of Jason tonight, satisfying his own desires and staff.
Once he's provoked, doesn't he have a right to proceed?
I don't believe he does. I mean, he has a right to, well, first of all, they're talking provocation and serious provocation. I don't believe that he's seriously provoked sufficient to cause death. It's sufficient to use deadly force. If there was some provocation, it has to be serious enough to, for him to be justified in using deadly force. And in this case, there's no justification for using deadly force.
So you said if there was provocation, it ceased when he chased them across the street?
It ceased when he came to achieve the purpose for which he came to court, which is to get him away from his spouse.
So you have varying degrees of provocation?
Well, I think not so varying degrees of provocation, but we don't have provocation that provoked the act, which is the act of question, which is the stabbing. That's what provoked him to make to approach, and maybe that's what provoked him to draw the knife and come forward. I don't think there's anything provoked in staff.
You can't nicely segregate in frame by frame the activities that take place there. I mean, you can't say, well, now, he was provoked, but he shouldn't have gone across the street. The provocation had ceased. He should have gone home. I mean, once you get into a situation and such as this is, you don't have the niceties of time and to think about things. You're saying that.
But I'm saying
that there was sufficient. Are you saying there was sufficient provocation at the beginning to do something, but once he ran across the street, it ceased? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying there was no provocation
at all
to incite use of deadly force.
Period.
I think there are different degrees of provocation. And I think it's been discussed that we're talking about serious. I think this was indeed an ashamed provocation. It must be serious provocation. It's not just any provocation.
Why is that not a jury issue? Isn't that what the Court of Appeals essentially says? Is that the jury can determine that. What is serious provocation? How can we determine here what is serious provocation? It's almost a matter of law, isn't it? Don't we have to decide that as a matter of law?
I mean, in
the way you're arguing.
I don't think that we did as you did. I think that in this particular instance, I think that when the court is supposed to get into line, the court's supposed to make a decision here. The trial court should make a decision with discretion.
I think he's still saying that.
To look at the situation and determine whether there's been a sufficient provocation. There's clearly the requirements that the provocation sufficient to such a force. I think that we have to treat it on the end. And as a matter of law, the trial court can say that that's not sufficient. Sufficient provocation is a force. If the trial court can make that determination, in the case of a person who's unarmed, we're treating it.
If the victim here had thrown the can of mace, or say he had a brick, and he threw the brick at the defendant, and then retreated, the provocation ends when he begins to retreat?
I think the provocation used deadly force does, because he's now unarmed on the street.
If he had shot his wife, what if he shot the wife, and now he's running away? Pardon? No gun. I mean, the retreating man, you might not always be right about that. In terms of a mitigating factor.
I think that person retreated well enough away from any point where there was any fear that he spoke of earlier, that said that fear. If his claims of provocation were fear, and yelling at her to get in the house, not being too bothered with harm, but just kind of yelling at her.
You've answered it, counsel. Your time's up, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Demarante. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.